The Tom Woods Show, episode 1625.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Come on now, folks. If you ain't going to start that side hustle now, then when? Check out my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income, where I take you step by step through five things that I do that keep food on the Woods household table and how you can do them too. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. No virus discussed today. Maybe a little bit. Might come out a little bit. But something a little bit lighter we could all probably use. This is actually an appearance that I made on a podcast that has not aired yet, but it's a podcast hosted by a friend of mine who will allow me to use it in advance. And that is Roger McCaffrey, who's been a guest on the show several times in the past. One of my best friends in the world, godparent to two of my daughters, and just an all-around great guy. He belongs to the illustrious McCaffrey family, who started Arlington House Publishers, which was publishing people like Murray Rothbard in the 1970s, at a time when it was very hard to find a publisher to publish a lot of our people. So, for example, the Conceived in Liberty series, the multiple-volume series on colonial America that Rothbard wrote, was initially published by Arlington House Publishers. So they were very, very important. So Roger's family deserves our respect and our thanks for the contributions they've made. Roger, Roger's not a libertarian, but, you know, when you think about the policies he favors, I can't tell the difference, basically. You know, we're always denouncing the state together. But this is one of these cases where, we should bear in mind, Murray Rothbard was very close friends with Neil McCaffrey, Roger's father, even though they couldn't agree about the Cold War. But man, did they have a lot in common, and they enjoyed the same music and so on and on. Well, Roger and I have an awful lot in common, and I guess I've probably known him for over 25 years now. So it's quite some time. But anyway, he's doing a series on his podcast, Catholic Book Radio, which I'll link to at tomwoods.com/1625, called Personalities, where he's just talking to people and talking about them and their careers and lives. And won't that be fun? Well, I'm going to keep it fun because any conversation with Roger is a lot of fun. He's just an interesting guy, and I think you'll enjoy this conversation. So here we go.
Tom Woods.
Roger McCaffrey, glad to talk to you.
It's by phone. You know, we're in lockdown. You're in lockdown. We're in the middle of the plague. And so we were going to get together and talk. You're one of the early guests on our new series called Personalities. Most of them are going to be Catholic. Probably one or two Lutherans, now that the Pope has gone and celebrated Luther's 500th anniversary. He called him a great man and so forth. So we can, you know, we could probably have a couple of Lutherans on. And they might make, they might make better Catholics than the Pope. I don't know. I don't even want to go there, Tom.
I know some Lutherans I would entrust my kids' education to more than some people in Rome. Let's just say that.
Oh, I completely agree. But one of the two that I could mention actually converted. And you're the third Lutheran I actually know, have shaken hands with.
A former Lutheran. Let's not confuse people.
No, it's not former Lutheran. Yes, please. Former Lutheran. But I think when I first met you, and this is going to be partly a biographical program, you were in fact a Lutheran. I mean, it was a Lutheran phase. But you weren't comfortable with it.
Yeah, we met in 1993. I know exactly when we met. 1993, John Randolph Club, right. San Mateo, California. I think I was the right. youngest attendee. And this was the right. meeting where Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell met up with the people from Chronicles magazine. They're now condemned for this today, for
right.
doing
well,
that.
Who's condemning? But who condemns who?
Let's say the left-leaning libertarian world thinks the worst thing you can do is reach out to people on the right. On the left, you're just dealing with people who have a few misguided ideas, but their hearts are in the right place. But the right is poison. And it's at that level. You know, it's that level.
So in other words, it's the old battle for the heart and soul of the movement line.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I got to meet some great people through that Randolph Club. Really great. I mean, Clyde Wilson, really smart. I met Paul Gottfried, Tom Fleming, whom...
Right. So we have to, Clyde Wilson is the Southern, I won't call him an agrarian, but he probably is.
But he's a Southern historian who's extremely respected basically by any academic. I mean, like, they realize this guy knows the material, but he's hardcore.
Right.
He's old right, Buchanan style guy.
Right. Yeah, I certainly remember him. In fact, he probably was involved in the Buchanan campaign. But if he was an organizer, God bless him, that was not one of his talents. So they probably didn't do that well in his precinct. But yeah, of course, he's formidable. But then he would have to go to prison in the next Democratic administration, as many of us might. I mean, we're getting that close. We're one Joe Biden away, since he won't be running his own White House, of course. So, you know, it'll be in the hands of a bunch of utter communists and radicals of various sorts. So anything is possible once that, what are we calling Mr. Biden?
Oh, geez, I don't know.
Once that lecher gets into the White House. Anyhow, but back to you, not to digress. And I was going to bring this up last, but since you use the L word, libertarianism, I'll bring it up first. Do you see it, and I don't want to talk deep philosophy, it frightens and confuses me, but do you see libertarianism as either a way of life or an alternative worldview to my own, let's say? You know me fairly well. I'm an eclectic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is not a way of life. Not supposed to be, but it appeals to me for reasons that are different from why it might appeal to other people. I understand why it appeals to people who just don't fit in anywhere, people who don't like authority, and they don't like traditional established institutions. They feel like this is the thing that'll tear them all down. I understand why it attracts people like that. And as long as those people don't bother me, I'm not going to bother them. But what attracts me to it is, I feel like, certainly in the, you know, in the world we live in, what I think first drew me to it before I agreed with the philosophy was, just as a matter of fact, I feel like the regime I live under is clearly and obviously my enemy. It can't stand the sight of me, and there's no way it can be reformed. And people who try to reform it are worse, wind up being worse than the people we were reforming. To see people, I think, are people of goodwill who mean well, but they just don't pay close attention. To see them snookered into donating money to this or that campaign or this or that think tank, when, you know, that's just basically going up people's noses or whatever. I mean, it's not being spent on anything worthwhile, when they could take that money and build something with it. You know, that just irritates me. So I feel like anything good that's going to come in civilization is going to come parallel to and outside of that institution. And I just cannot be convinced otherwise.
Well, then I'm going to give up. You just saved me 10 minutes, because I would have tried to convince you. Yeah. No, in a sense, you know, and obviously you have to pick and choose your candidates, but he who is deeply despised by the media zeitgeist, which really is Hollywood, the big media, and the academic establishment, which has vast influence and power. He who is despised by them and makes them want to throw up has a chance to get a $1,000 donation from me.
That I understand. I can be very sympathetic.
They're not a warmonger.
I can understand that. But I'm thinking, like, I don't want to mention the name, but let's just say somebody you and I respect very much, a campaign of that person. I was speaking to somebody who worked on the campaign of this person you and I respect. I'm not going to say who it is. It may not be the person people are thinking of. And this person who worked on it said to me, after my experience working on this campaign, I will never donate another dollar to anyone running for anything after I've seen what happens to it.
Well, I'm glad I'm a moderate.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. You're in between. Right.
Because I would still consider donating depending on circumstances. And so that's why I get at this way of life / philosophy question. Because I have no problem with, you know, market economics. It's simply a description of reality in detail. But I question whether that has to dominate my day.
It shouldn't.
And
Any more than politics should dominate your day.
Right, right. Well, but sometimes politics has to when you're under imminent threat.
Yeah, and, right. But that's my point, is that that's the fact that we have to deal with it. Like, for example, people who their entire, every aspect of their lives and every aspect of the way they interact with people is ultimately political. They have to know, are you boycotting Heinz ketchup or whatever the heck the thing is now, you know,
right,
or not? And if you're
right,
not,
right,
then they can't be friends with you. That, I mean, that's a sickness. There's something right wrong with that kind of person. They can't be human anymore.
So, fair enough, obviously, I
get the point of view that, you know, you might not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. Yeah, I mean, look, I have a podcast that talks about it all the time. I get that.
Right.
I guess what I'm saying is I wish I had a world where I felt like I could actually make a meaningful decision, you know, that they weren't all out
right
of my hands or out of the hands
right
of my friends and neighbors, you know, which, you know, in which everything wasn't driven by soulless lizard people repeating sound bites. That's my, when I say politics takes up too much of our lives, I mean that.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. But if, you know, if the state is the chief protector of parents who are killing their unborn children, it's time to make common cause with somebody, at least some of the time. That's really my point. And I can still be in favor of zero taxes and a wide array of Mises positions, including abolishing the Fed, although I'm probably going to call them and try to borrow some money now that the Fed is allowing people like me to borrow money. But I can understand all that, but if the state is using its power, which we both despise, for wicked ends, I mean, sometimes you got to, you know, if you're Tom Woods, you might have to consider running for governor on the Republican Party line. That is, if you think you can get elected.
It would just be awful, Roger.
All right.
The things they would say about me in that campaign would be unthinkable.
Plus, I agree. I'm pretty outraged at them.
Maybe I'm not a good enough person for this, but I just don't want to be governor. And I know that
right,
maybe
well,
I should rise to the occasion and do what's expected of you, but I just don't want to. I could
okay
help somebody else. Somebody who's going to do some good, I wouldn't mind helping somebody else, but I can't do it.
Yeah. All right.
And
all
I would
right
secretly help
that
them because I don't want to ruin their careers. I'd secretly help them. I'd write
well
their speeches
course
and they could pay me under the table and no one would be the wiser.
Well, of course. That goes without saying. Okay. I skipped over your very brief biography, but you allude to it now, the TomWoods.com. I mean, you're somebody who's earning a very, very, very and extremely just wage.
Exactly. I consider it quite just. After all the hell I've put myself through over the years.
Right. So we need to trace back. You graduated Harvard. That's why I met you right after you were finished at Harvard, a year or two at the most. And you're heading for Columbia University. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's take it from there, you know, and talk for the focus on the books, not one after another. We don't want to put our audience to sleep, but, you know, you did a dozen books. And now you're dissing books as if they're obsolete.
I like books. I like reading them, and I like reading the old fashioned book, the physical book. I have a Kindle, and I thought at first, I mean, you can understand why somebody would think that's more convenient. If I'm flying and I'm reading like a 1,000-page book, it's clunky, and I could just have this. But you know what? I'd rather have the clunky 1,000-page book. It just never really worked for me. But what I don't like about books is writing them. It is a. I mean, you know, you've done it. It's a very, very challenging thing, very mentally and physically taxing.
Yes.
And then you got to go around and be a salesman all the time. Now, I'm a salesman a lot. You know, I'm always promoting something.
Right.
Doggone it, to be a salesman for this thing that earns you like $2 a copy, it is tiring. You know, and you're just constantly obsessed with publicizing it all the time.
I'm afraid there are very, very few listeners who are going to sympathize with this, Tom.
But my point is, there are ways I can more comfortably make a living that don't make these kind of demands on me. You put all this effort in, and yes, sometimes you have a big hit, and sometimes it sells,
right,
let's say, not as much as a big hit does.
Okay, well, all right. Well, let's cut to the big hits, because you've had at least two. First of all, you were condemned, and this is what made me realize that you were important. You were condemned on the New York Times editorial page.
I was.
On the op-ed page, on the editorial page itself.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And I was so dumb in those days, Roger. I thought this was a bad thing. This was the best thing they could have done for me.
Of course. I was going to say, people build careers on that.
I was so stupid. I mean, it's understandable. I was a young academic, and I thought this meant my life was over. But of course, it only after they did that, the book we're talking about is The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. After they did that, the book cracked the top 10 in the bestseller list.
Their bestseller list.
Yeah,
their bestseller. Okay, well, that book itself, it's timeless, really. Yeah, you could update it, I suppose, because it's 15 years old or whatever.
But, yeah, as one of these days, I will do that. I'll add another chapter or something.
It's The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. Correct?
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes, right.
Okay. And you can still buy it, no?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it still sells well, even now.
But it bothers you because you're only making $2 a copy on that. How much work have you done on that book?
It's, in the last 10 years? All right. So I get what you're saying, that there is an upfront amount of effort, but the royalties keep coming in. But bear in mind, that's highly unusual. I know most people, not you, but most people think an author writes a book, it automatically sells at least 50,000 copies, bare minimum if it's a big failure, and then he collects the royalties for the next 10 years. No, most books sell about 1,000 copies if they're lucky, and the author earns pretty much zero. That's what usually happens.
And then he blames the publisher. I've been on both sides of this.
Oh, yeah, he blames the publisher. Right. And by the way, sometimes he's right, because the publisher, meanwhile, most of these publishers are putting out thousands of titles a year. They can't put their marketing arm behind all these. Most of the time, you're left hanging out to dry.
So, well, your publishers may be 1,000 titles, but I mean, you know, most publishers do a few dozen titles.
Regnery does a few dozen titles. Yeah, Regnery, and they were great.
Oh, you mean book. You mean prints.
Yeah.
They print. Yeah, absolutely. But and you have to get online as an author and all that. But anyway, that was a Times bestseller. Then you had another one.
Yeah,
equally
Meltdown.
Valid today. Meltdown. I remember that was an ordeal for you because you had to write it in 2 months.
You know, it was awful. They originally told me I had to write it in 3 weeks. I said,
and that was after the
crash. It was after the financial crisis of 2008.
Of 2008, let's distinguish, because right now we're talking in 2020.
Yeah, right.
We're in the middle of another one.
Yeah. So that was, the reason they did that was they said, everybody in the world's going to write a book on this, and those people are going to have more name recognition than you. So the only advantage you would have is being first to market. So you've got to get this thing out fast. So I said I could do it in 5 weeks, and we compromised on a month. It was
that's an achievement.
Yeah.
Horrible, but it was an achievement because you did hit the Times list again.
Yes, I did. This time they learned their lesson from last time, which was if we write a negative review, he just sells more. So if we write a positive review, of course, that's unthinkable. So when you would look at the bestseller list online, all the books on the list were hyperlinked to reviews in the Times, except mine. Mine had no link because it was not mentioned or reviewed by anybody. But it was great. I got a lot of TV exposure, big radio, because people wanted to know what the heck caused this crisis. And I just, it was true. I had done. And the thing is, when I first proposed this book, I proposed it. I called up Ron Paul actually. And I said, you should write the book on the financial crisis because you have the name recognition and the credibility as somebody who's been ringing alarm bells for years. And you're the guy who stood on the House floor in 2001 or 2002, one of those two early years, way before anybody else, and said, they are replacing the dot-com bubble with a housing bubble. That's what's happening. You said
that. Yeah, wow, that was perfect.
It's amazing. And so, I mean, at the Mises Institute, you can find people in like 2004 warning about it. This is like even before that. And I said, you got to write this book. And he just didn't have it. He just didn't want, he said, well, I've already said everything I want to say. And I already have, I've written a lot of articles. And I said, that's what makes it easy. You take the articles, you put them together. Like, I'll do it for you if you want. We'll take the articles together. You make them into a book. And I just couldn't talk him into it. So I said, well, if I wrote this book, would you write the foreword to it? So I guilted him into writing the foreword, which did not hurt sales, by the way. Foreword by Ron Paul.
No, it didn't. Sure didn't. And the rest is history.
Yeah, that worked. It was a horrible month, but I'm glad I did it.
Well, I remember talking to you maybe for 5 minutes. That your idea of relaxing was to talk to me for 5 minutes.
Yeah, things are pretty rough.
The other book is Nullification.
Yeah, right? That's another one. That was 2010.
What's that full title of that one? That's an
something like How to Resist. I beg your pardon?
The three books we've just discussed, or the third one now, Nullification. Those are important for everybody who feels they need to bone up on their history and economics ought to read.
I appreciate that. Yeah, Nullification, the subtitle was something like How to Resist Federal Tyranny in the 21st Century. And it was trying to resurrect an idea of not just Thomas Jefferson, but really a lot of important early Americans, that the idea of the United States is not that you have one indivisible blob, you know, with a central government that just dictates to everybody. That if you look at the Constitution, it refers to the United States in the plural, because that's what it is. It's a collection of states. And it was the states that created the central government. So the states still have kind of supposed to have a watchful eye over it. I mean, after all, they created the thing, for heaven's sake. They can't be prisoners of it, ultimately. And so in the last resort, they can say, you've exceeded your powers. We're the one who gave you the powers, for heaven's sake, and we're not going to let you do that in our state. And so I went through the history of it, totally unknown history. Especially early American history, of states appealing to these principles, whether it was over Jefferson's embargo or John Adams's Alien and Sedition Acts, you know, making it basically a crime to criticize the U.S. president, or the prospect of a military draft for the War of 1812. Daniel Webster stood up and said, Massachusetts is just not going to do that, and we're going to prevent you from doing that. Whether it was protective tariffs, one thing or another, there were a lot of policies where the states just said, we're not going to go along with it. And this was taken as a legitimate point of view, at least, by a lot of people.
Right. And it still might be.
And it still might be. Of course, today, you know, if you say anything involving the states, they think, well, they don't actually think. They say,
yeah,
you want to bring back segregation or something. But, I mean, nobody in his right mind thinks that. But, you know, you say the word state, and that's what they think. But in this day and age, you see the states exerting their authority in a variety of ways. I mean, on the one hand, you've seen some states pushing back against Obamacare and gun regulations. But you've also seen the states intervening on questions involving some drugs or the FDA and having the right to try potentially life-saving drugs even without FDA approval. I mean, these are things that could appeal to a broad spectrum of folks.
Of course. It really is not – it transcends the old left-right
It does.
Thing. And you will look with Mayor – what Cuomo and the governor of New York, New Jersey – three governors, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, in this COVID-19 pandemic – you know, with ease got together and basically, you know, totalitarianized life in those three states for whatever. They'll let us know when it's okay to come outside again, you know. And that proves that sort of anybody can do it with regard to states opposing other entities, other governmental entities.
But isn't it interesting that when the states use their power to do, you know, things that are more extreme than what the federal government wants, nobody objects to that. It's when they say, we don't want to do what they're doing. We want to keep a window of freedom open. Then everybody's up in arms.
Yeah. Well, I see a clash coming and not that far from now either. And then there may be regionalism where you have states that are a little Confederate groupings to be very, it's ironic, isn't it? Over God knows what, but you can easily see that coming. So suppose a dollar melts down in a second Trump term, which is by no means assured. But just supposing it does, and suddenly the feds can't help the states the way they have. I mean, it's going to be some real regional tensions by then. And the Midwest is going to have to assert itself, I believe, in that case. Against the coasts, could get interesting. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but anyway, the whole idea of nullification and states asserting themselves is not over. You were a little early, I suppose.
Yeah.
I remember Rothbard talking about that with my father, Neil McCaffrey, 30 years ago. You know, my father, early in the game, thought that there would be a secessionist movement in the U.S. I remember talking to him myself about that in the 1980s. So, and I can find you memos that he wrote to, you know, a handful of friends, you know, in politics and in academia. And probably Lou Rockwell has seen one or two of those, which make that pretty, it's a pretty interesting case, that's all.
Yeah.
Anyhow. So, but you've got the Church and the Marketplace, or the Church and the Market? What's that book?
The Church and the Market. Yeah, it's from 2005. And then I added
that time. Well,
that's a long time ago. I added another chapter.
Well, I know, okay.
Yeah, 10 years later, they did a 10th anniversary edition. And I just thought, geez, that's how you know you're approaching middle age, at least when your books are having anniversaries.
I know. That's very disturbing. Just the idea that I've known you for 28 years is disturbing.
It's ridiculous. I mean, what the heck? I was a kid. You were a kid, basically.
I know. Well, you're still in your 40s, so you qualify. You qualify.
I'm hanging on for dear life.
You really have no right to talk. You have no right to talk until you're 50. I don't really want to hear you. You have to go rewrite your books.
You know, actually,
when you get mature.
What I need to do, frankly, is go reread my books. I bet I would learn a lot of stuff I've forgotten.
Yeah, well, that's talking about a disturbing experience. That's one. Go rereading these books that were formative to me, for example, and realize that I've forgotten 90% of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm telling my son to read them urgently.
That's the spirit.
So, okay, but anyway, you've expressed your contempt for print books, at least to me privately. So that, but I'm curious are you ever going to write another book that one can pick up at a bookstore?
I haven't closed the door on it, but in the old days, I used to just always be working on a book because I just felt like that's what I should do. I'm an author, so what's the next book? What's the next book? And I don't want to do it for the sake of doing it. I want it to be something that moves me, that I just feel compelled to do, that I can't imagine not doing. And that's how I felt about Meltdown, because I thought no one else is going to do this. I mean, and really, there were a couple. I mean, Sowell did a book on the housing boom, but it wasn't really – it didn't cover the stock market. I mean, it wasn't thorough. So there really wasn't much from our side. And Richard Posner – who's kind of on our side, wrote a book, you know, blaming it on capitalism. And when people said, well, what about the Federal Reserve? He said, the Federal Reserve is part of capitalism. And I thought, how confused can you possibly be? So I felt like I had to do that. Whereas right now, I think I would just be forcing myself to do it.
I see. Okay, well, I'm sorry to hear that, but I'll come up with an idea that compels you.
You've come up with some titles that have been intriguing. I mean, I don't want to give them away because maybe you'll use them someday, but...
Well, I plan to, and you're going to be on the cover as the author.
We'll see.
Okay, so now, but there's one other book we should discuss, and I'm the one who asked you to do it. It's really, it's timeless, but it's hard to sell now, although I get orders at Roman Catholic Books. Our website, by the way, is booksforcatholics.com. That's one of my publishing endeavors, and it's called Sacred Then and Sacred Now, The Return of the Old Latin Mass, right?
Yes, indeed. I have it available on tomwoods.com on the books page.
Okay.
And I get orders for it through that site once in a while, and I send signed copies to people.
Yeah, that's good, because it's an important book. It was written during the pontificate of Benedict XVI, right after he liberated and liberated the old Latin Mass and reinserted it in the heart of the church's life. And so he did two things. He didn't just say priests can say it. He said it had never been abrogated, and that a priest doesn't even have to ask his bishop, quote unquote. A priest has no need to ask his bishop for permission to use that missal. So
I wrote
an important book.
I wrote that book in bed. I remember late at night. I would just work on it in bed because I was working at the Mises Institute at that time. And obviously the book has nothing to do with the mission of the Mises Institute. So I did it in my spare time. And the point of it, first of all, it settled some arguments that had been going on in the Catholic world for a long time. For example, I mean, Benedict really settled the argument. Had the old Mass ever been truly abrogated? Well, there were the lapdogs all said that it had. And then Benedict said that it hadn't. So we win automatically. We win. But I accelerated that. I tried to accelerate that by marshaling evidence. And there's a chapter in there going through Benedict's thought about the liturgy, and it brings together from a lot of different sources what Benedict's thought was and presents it in a coherent whole. Then there's a part of it that walks people through the old Mass, because if you go there for the first time, you are not going to know what's happening. That's just a fact. You're not going to be able to follow. You're not going to know what's going on. And so I walk people through step by step, the stuff that I wanted to know the first time I went, but was not told. And then things like, you know, common misconceptions and responding to them, like, you know, what's the point of having a Mass in a dead language and all that stuff? Why is the priest facing the altar and all that? All those sorts of common objections are responded to. Because, as you say, this was a moment in the church where there was the likelihood that more people were going to attend, and I wanted them not to be confused, and more than that, I wanted them not to bring their awful, destructive practices from their normal parish life into our beautiful parish life.
Right. Well, but the tone of the book is
you almost can't tell it's Tom Wood's writing. It's so restrained.
It's non-polemical. That's really, and we agreed that that would be the best tone. So, you know, people expecting to be humiliated by you, as others have in other categories. I'm afraid they're disappointed because you're just positive. Every page is positive.
And so, what's nice about that actually was that the book got really good reviews from a lot of you know, respectable sources like Alcuin Reed, who knows more about the liturgy than I'll ever know, and a Homiletic and Pastoral Review, and all down the line, like major outlets said really, really nice things about it. So that's this is not, I mean, I know I'm not a professional liturgist, thank heavens, which is probably why I could write a book like that, but it's nice to write something that's outside my official area and have the result be that people who are in a position to have an opinion on it spoke well about it. I mean, even the Library Journal wrote something nice about it. You know, the Catholic World Report, the New Liturgical Movement, Publishers Weekly wrote something nice about it. You know, for something that's not my area, that's not bad.
Right. Well, I'm sorry that I probably wrote the Publishers Weekly for it. No, I get your drift. They actually assign their Catholic books to a specific reviewer who's an academic. I think I know who wrote that. And so, yeah, you're correct about that. I think if there's a new edition, we ought to put a banner at the top and say hate free. Because devoid of any of the vindication edition, yes, but hate free. Anyhow. Okay. So there are other books, but we better stop us boring our people. You know, I'm very protective of my listening audience of 17.
Fair enough.
So, okay, let's not ignore in a 5-minute segment, your theological odyssey, or am I dignifying what happened to you too much by putting it that way?
No, I don't.
Because you were.
No, what? Go ahead.
You changed your mind 3 or 4 times before you entered the church.
Yeah, that's right.
But you were an agnostic at one point.
Yes, I was. So, I mean, the long and the short of it is I went off to Harvard as an undergrad, and I met a guy there who I can't say his name because he's super mainstream and respectable and probably doesn't want to be associated with Woods anymore. But anyway, I met this guy and he took
who
me
does
out.
Who does that?
I beg your pardon?
Who does?
Yeah, who does? McCaffrey, because how many more bridges can a guy burn? Now, that's not true. You're much better at maintaining your bridges than I am with mine.
I don't know.
Well, what happened was he invited me to lunch one day and he just asked me, do you believe in absolute truth? And I thought, geez, I guess this is the kind of thing people talk about at lunches at Harvard. You know, I don't have conversations like this. I said, I don't know. I guess so. I don't know. So he wanted me to think seriously about religious questions, which I had not up to that time. And he said, look, I want you to read this book. And it was called Did Jesus Rise from the Dead? And it was the text of an Oxford debate between Anthony Flew, who at that time was among philosophers like the most celebrated atheist around. And then,
I remember.
Yeah, and then he became a theist toward the end of his life, which was very interesting. But on the other side of the debate was a guy named Gary Habermas. And so they debated it, and they had a neutral five-person panel who would decide each one would decide who they thought was the winner. Well, 3 out of 5 of them voted for Habermas as the winner. And I remember being shocked that that could be. Like, so going into this book, I knew that Habermas had been declared the winner. And I remember thinking, that's impossible, because how could you debate this, right? Isn't this all just taken on faith? And how could there be a debate? And certainly, how could the Christian be the winner? So it piqued my curiosity. I read the book. I thought it was convincing. So I started going to church with this guy. And heaven help me, Roger. And I'm not trying to insult anybody in my listening audience, but surely they'll understand that not everybody goes for the, let's say, Pentecostal charismatic style. It could not have turned me off more. But what impressed me... I beg your pardon?
Somebody from Harvard going to a Pentecostal church?
Yeah, I know. I don't understand it either. But the thing was, the pastor was very hardcore, very serious person, not frivolous in any way, not a Marxist. I mean, he was just really good and interesting and sound. And that impressed me. But I became convinced that probably Christianity was correct. But then the question was, which one am I supposed to be in? So for a while, I was a Baptist, and I found this theologically unsatisfying. I mean, I just felt like there was no history in it. It was like Christianity started yesterday with this church founded by these 3 people and their guitar. It just didn't seem, there was no oomph to it for me. Right. And I know, like right now, at this point, I'm systematically alienating one group after another. The more I go on, the agnostics, the atheists, now the Baptists, let's see what else we can do. I went to the Park Street Congregational Church or something in Boston for a while. But ultimately, I became a Lutheran because I had friends who were Lutherans, and I felt like they really were interested in church history. And they really did. They had great church music. They had some very impressive-looking churches. Not that this is how you decide these things, but I just felt like they had something more than we created a church in our living room, which just never, that just, I don't buy that. And
yeah, and you also had two smart Lutheran friends too.
I did. One of whom is a Lutheran pastor in Dallas right now, and the other of whom is a professor at Boston University. He teaches church history there, got his PhD from Harvard. These are smart, these aren't dummies. So if you go up to them and say,
smart,
well,
yeah,
you know, you should just as easily believe in the flying spaghetti monster, they would demolish you. So don't even try. Okay. But I couldn't, but eventually even Lutheranism seemed unsatisfying to me, because I remember at one point the thing turns not just on Luther's view of justification, but other questions like, is the Mass a sacrifice? And Luther said, look, even if all the fathers of the church said it was a sacrifice, I would still reject that. And I thought, ooh, I don't know. I mean, could I And I remember the thing, one of the turning point moments was I was reading a book on Aquinas in my room, and this friend of mine came in and said, why are you reading a book about a heretic? And I thought, what? So I can't get anything from Thomas Aquinas? Really? So I began to think, it's really alienating being a Lutheran. So I can't like this guy. I can't read about that one. I can't, for like 1,000 years, I can't get anything from anybody. Now, I know I'm going to get Lutherans writing to me saying, well, your Lutheran friend didn't quite understand. Okay, maybe he didn't, but that was certainly the impression I was getting. And so that's when I reached out to old McCaffrey. This is 1995. And I said,
oh, yes.
I think I'm considering, because there were other stories. I started reading. I went to Eucharistic Adoration once. A lot of things just added up for me. It just seemed to me, I read Cardinal Newman's essay on the development of Christian doctrine, and it just seemed to me, as he would put it, antecedently likely that there would be a visible structure to the church.
Right.
It just seemed like that made sense.
Right.
So I reached out to McCaffrey and I said, I'm thinking I might convert, but I mean, what do you think I should be reading? And McCaffrey, of course, is the editor of Roman Catholic Books. So within a week, a giant box arrives at my door filled with books. I had asked the correct person.
And that's good. I'm glad you reminded me of that, because, and I'm sure I know half of the titles I stuck in. Anyway, the fact that it wasn't stolen and I sent it into New York City, that's the miracle.
Yeah, no kidding. So I read those, and then what was the other thing? So I entered the church in 1996, and you and your wife Priscilla were there, and we went out for dinner afterward. Do you remember the toast that you raised?
I'm sorry. Forgive me for
that. I remember distinctly. You raised a glass and said, well, Tom, welcome to the Titanic.
Oh. Oh, that's, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Old times.
Have I been wrong on that? Yeah, well, that's a good note to end on, actually.
Maybe so.
So, we'll continue this because there's many topics, but let's end here because seven of my listeners are left.
Maybe some joined.
No, they just got wind of another $1 trillion bailout package. Remember, it's only Thursday this week, so there's got to be another trillion or two coming.
Yeah.
So they just left to get the details.
Well, glad to be able to do this anyway.
Thanks, Tom. We'll catch up. It's too bad we couldn't do it in person, but you're not allowed out of your house down there in that county.
And yeah, I'm not sure you're allowed to visit me at my house at this point. So,
well, I think you're right. I probably would be stopped at one of the bridges.
It's too bad because your commentary about the house is half the fun of the show.
Oh, I had some choice remarks for you, but we'll do that next time.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Roger.
Later. Thanks, Tom.
All right, folks, that's the episode for today. Tomorrow, also no virus. But Monday of next week, probably virus. We're going to try to balance virus and non-virus here on the podcast. Not sure how else to do this, so that is the approach we are taking. Remember those people who did that excellent documentary series we all liked called Money Revealed, and they had John Mackey on from Whole Foods, who's a libertarian, and G. Edward Griffin, of course, who wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island, and Robert Kiyosaki, who wrote Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and a whole bunch of other people. They did this great documentary series. We all loved it last year. They released one episode for free every day. Well, they're doing the same thing this year, except this year it's called Crisis Investing 2020. What the heck do you do with your money at a time like this? Legitimate question. Of course, if you raise this question, people automatically assume you want your grandmother to die. But I think you are allowed to think about both things at once. So I strongly recommend that you go sign up for that, because if you sign up in advance, you can get all the episodes for free as they come out. So tomwoods.com/crisis is the link for that. So you can get every episode for nothing at tomwoods.com/crisis. Probably some good viewing, since we're all stuck at home anyway. Might as well watch something other than just a binge TV show, which I'm doing a little bit of myself. But this is as good a time as any to learn this information. All right, see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.